From WXXI News, this is Unleashed, the pet show on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome to Unleashed, the pet show. It is the third Friday of the month, and that means third Friday of the month, first hour, is Unleashed, the pet show. It's the show that aims to talk about pets and their people. And we're going to branch out a little bit beyond cats and dogs this hour. That's always sort of the focus, it seems. But there's a lot to talk about. Cats, dogs, and beyond. You can call right now. Dr. Eric Harima is here from Penfield Veterinary Hospital. He's here for the hour. So if you have any questions about your pets, cats, dogs, or otherwise, you can call right now. And the number to call is 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255. You can tweet your questions to the hashtag Unleashed. You can find me on Twitter at Evan Dawson. And if you're right here in Rochester, you can call 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Dr. Harima is here. It's nice to have you here. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you today, Evan?
Very good. We had a number of questions for this morning, including at least one from a listener who wanted me to find out if cats can drink tree water. And I actually have several cats, and I have two cats now. We used to have three. We've got two. And we have the same question. And every night we hear them drinking the tree water. Can cats drink the tree water if you've got a Christmas tree in the house?
Well, I think you've just answered your own question. My cats drink the tree water. I've got a puppy in the house now who's drinking the tree water. I'm not sure what the attraction is to the tree water, but yes, they can. From a standpoint of anything toxic in the trees, you know, theoretically, what might be coming into the water is already in the environment. You know, if you think about, cats and dogs outside drinking water from puddles and streams are probably more likely to get, you know, some contaminants from drainage outside versus what's coming from your tree.
Okay. And so no real concern, but if you notice maybe they're getting sick, I mean, is it possible they could get sick off it?
My previous career, I was a chemist, and I did a lot of work of environmental chemistry, and, you know, some of the terpenes are some of the chemicals that come from, you know, pine trees and that type of thing. And the amounts you're talking about are so minimal. Mm-hmm. No. I mean, if you see some issues, you know, vomiting, GI upset, diarrhea, certainly talk to your veterinarian. But I think you've answered your own question, the fact that your cats do it routinely.
Yeah.
And they're there the next morning ready for another bowl of food. And
Every night I'm like, we've got, their names are Mama Cat and Sarah. And I'm going, Mama, please just don't drink. And she looks at me like, I've been doing this for years. I'm 14 years old. It's all I want. All right. So,
exactly.
You know, so what are you going to do? How do you go from being a chemist to being a veterinarian?
Just point of clarity, you know, I was a chemical engineer, originally, and started working as an environmental chemist, and, it just didn't excite me. And, at that point, when I was working and understood what work meant and paying the bills and, you know, the daily grind, I decided it was time to do something I better enjoy do it for a lifetime.
My wife was a forensic chemist by trade, did that for a number of years, and then left to become a portrait photographer for high school seniors. So totally unrelated. So something about you chemists, I guess. You do the chemistry thing for a while. Dr. Harima will be here for the hour. He is a veterinarian from Penfield Veterinary Hospital. I see the phone starting to ring. We'll get to your calls in just a second. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. It's supposed to be getting cold. I mean, so far, we've got like a nothing winter or late. Let's see here. What's the day? It's the last few days of fall. Very, very mild, obviously, through December. But it will get cold. Last couple winters were really, really brutal. In general, what do you want people to know about their animals this time of year as we move into those raw months of weather?
I think a lot of it comes down to general common sense. Think about yourself and what you would do, you know, outside and how cold it is. What are the temperatures like? What's the wind like? And you know, in general, you know, I've got two cats. They go outside. Do they stay outside the way they do in the spring and summer and fall? Absolutely not. You know, they're outside maybe for a couple minutes and then want to come back in. But in general, if you feel like your hands are going to get cold, you think about their paws. You know, they're walking on their paws, and certainly they can get frostbite and have issues with contact mm-hmm. sensitivities with salts and things like that. So
my concern with cats is always, well, really animals in general, but I feel like especially cats, they're not going to show you any sort of pain or discomfort unless it's really acute. I don't know if that's true or not, but I've always found that you know, we had a cat who passed away from a tumor a couple of years ago, and boy, you never knew anything was wrong until the very, very end. And I'm sure there were things that were building up to that. We just didn't know because they're not expressing. Do cats sort of hide pain or discomfort pretty well?
They're masters at hiding pain, and I think it depends on the type of pain you're talking about. So, you know, if you think about a cat who's got, you know, frostbitten toes, they're going to let you know because it's going to hurt, and they're walking on their legs, so they're going to be limping or licking excessively, you know, showing signs of issues that way. I think some of the things you're talking about is our cats are aging, might be more internal type pain, and, you know, that's kind of something where they do kind of, you know, when they start hiding and not showing up as they normally do through the course of the day, that's when you probably have an issue on your hands.
Yeah, I in general, and we're going to get to the phones now, in general, I just think, especially for cats, but for your animals, don't wait for them to tell you they're in discomfort. Try to be proactive about it this time of year.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
All right, so to the phones we go. And so if you're waiting, here we go. We've got Amy, Keith, Debbie, and let's start with Amy and Menden. First up with Dr. Eric Harima. Go ahead, Amy.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I have a 15-year-old, approximately 15-year-old border collie. I rescued her 13 years ago, and she quite suddenly, about 2 months ago, lost all hearing. She has been rubbing her head on things that she walks by, like the sofa or the bed. I cleaned her ears. I can't find anything. I didn't know if this is something like like earwax or debris, or if it's simply a part of old age. But it was a very, very sudden change where one day she could hear it, the next day she couldn't.
Hi, thanks for calling in. And certainly, as our pets get older, hearing loss is something that that you can appreciate that can be related to normal age-related changes. I think as hearing loss goes on, it's amazing, you know, just talking about what animals can hide or not necessarily hide, but how they adapt. And so, you know, there may have been, you know, kind of a progression of hearing loss to the point where all of a sudden, you know, your border collie was not hearing anymore. But, you know, in an acute change like that, any history of ear infections or previous issues that you've had to address or any medicines other than ear cleaning solutions being put in the ear?
No, she's had some neurological issues, and she was a rescue and she was severely abused. So we really don't have much of a history on her. But there was never an ear infection or a need for cleaning the ears or using drying solution or any of those treatments.
Yeah, so, you know, I think certainly an evaluation by your veterinarian, just to have a look through the ear canals into the, you know, to visualize the eardrum if possible. You know, most of the diseases we're going to see occur in the external ear canal versus the middle or inner ear for our pets. And evaluating the middle and inner ear are much more difficult. You know, to do so. But if you have an intact eardrum, you know, certainly there's probably nothing going on in the external ear canal. But to interrogate the middle and inner ear is a little bit harder. And, you know, it just really depends on how far you're willing to go to try and find out if there's something else deeper into the ear.
Right. Well, thank you. She doesn't do well with that appointment. She's it's very difficult for her. It's very stressful. So it's kind of a fine balance between putting her through some testing and just dealing with her, you know, signing to her versus being able to speak to her. She responds and she looks for us. So she's adapting in other ways.
And I guess the only concern that I have about your history is that she was rubbing her head or her ear, you know, and if that's something that she normally doesn't do, you know, it could be as simple as a foreign body, you know, something stuck down, you know, further into the ear canal that, you know, just, you know, is bothering her that way as well.
Thank you so much.
Good luck, Amy. Thanks for the phone call. Let's go to Keith in Greece. Next up with Dr. Eric Harima. Go ahead, Keith.
Yes. You were talking about animals drinking the water from the trees. And I don't do the natural trees anymore, but years ago when I did, I think there was a lot of products that you could add to the water to make them fireproof or to make them last longer. Is that an issue if people are using that in their tree water? Concerned about whether that has chemicals that are bad for the pets?
Certainly it could be. And honestly, I'm not aware of any products or what might be in those products, you know, from a chemical, you know, standpoint. So if there are things people are adding in, I think the you know, using common sense and calling, looking at least the product and see if there's any warnings against ingestion and, you know, if you're concerned, call the producer of the product before. But yeah, if you're putting something in there, I'd think twice about letting your pets drink it for sure.
Sure. I mean, if it's basic water, Dr. Harima is telling us that any sort of concern about what's coming off the tree into the water that your cat or an animal might be drinking is very minimal, not likely to do harm. But yeah, if you're putting some sort of a fire retardant on the tree or in the water, that's probably different. But Keith, that's a good point, because it's a good reminder that sometimes it's not just water in there. Let's get to Debbie and Webster next up. Go ahead, Debbie.
Hi. We have had pleasure horses and trail horses for ages, and we have a new breed we've never had before. And I bought him at the end of August, and they delivered him the middle of October. And I was just appalled when he was delivered, because he was literally skin and bone. So we wondered if he had some sort of a metabolic digestive issue, and looked and found that there's EM, I believe it is, and he's a Clydesdale. And what we'd like to know is how much food should we feed him to build him back up again? He's getting high protein and high fat, but at 1,600 pounds, how many quarts a day should I be giving it?
Wow, Debbie, you're taking me back to the days of vet school. I haven't worked with horses since then. How old is the Clydesdale?
He's 13, and he's absolutely beautiful. And he eats well. He seems perfectly healthy otherwise, but he was in great shape in August. And then October, when he arrived, his ribs were showing, and he was very thin, and his hips, you could see the point.
And,
we're just appalled.
And you had mentioned, did I hear EPM?
I wondered if he might have, we did some research, and there's the metabolic problem where they don't absorb sugars, I believe, effectively. So they recommended a high protein and high fat diet, which I've gotten for him, but I'm not sure how much volume to feed him.
Okay. So, you know, I think obviously that would be a question for an equine veterinarian, which I am not, and I wish I could give you a better answer. But I think bottom line, if he was in good body condition in August, and we've got, you know, 2 to 3 months that have gone by, I would try and access vet records or have any history. But, you know, certainly got to think about parasites, you know, if he's been on a routine deworming program and that type of thing. But I would contact one of the local equine veterinarians, and I think Dr. Ann Dwyer out of Genesee Equine Valley Clinic, I think is what it's called. She would be a great resource for that.
Well, I hope that helps. And Debbie, thanks for the phone call. Horses live, how long can a horse live, Dr. Harriman?
Oh, they can get up to 30 plus years of age.
30 plus years, yeah. So this is 13, yeah. So yeah, okay. Well, I hope that helps, Debbie. And this is a timely phone call. This is Sam in Rochester, but I'm going to go to Sam in Rochester in a second. It's timely because Sam has a question about an animal that gets agitated when people come around. And this is the time of year with house parties and things going on, family gatherings, that if you've got animals that, you know, either are older or more easily agitated, it can be difficult. And so let me bring in Sam with his question. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, thank you for taking the call. I have a Jack Russell that's mixed with Pinscher. And the first year I had her, anybody could come around the car and they could just, you know. But now, I guess that she's gotten a little older. She's about 6 years old now, human-like. And anybody comes around the car, she is just barking and barking. She will bite if they don't watch it. You know, I just wonder, is there anything that you can do? I mean, she's just so possessive, you know, over me. Even when people are in the house and they try to hug me on the way out, if I don't watch it, she'll bite them. So I mean, what can you, I guess it's her being attached to me like that.
How often does she get to see, you know, see strangers or people? I mean, is this like on a daily occurrence, or is this just like once every month or two? You know, how often does she see strangers?
I take her for rides all the time. All the time I take her for a ride. I mean, I take her rides in the country, to the store. Everywhere I go, she wants to go with me, and I take her with me. Matter of fact, her and I just went and delivered some donuts, and we were on our way back. But she just gets so agitated when anybody comes around me.
Well, you know,
even my wife, even my wife, even when my wife, you know, my wife, like, she'll play like she's hitting me. She'll go after my wife's ankles.
So part of that may be that she's bonded to you and you only, and so, you know, she may see others, you know, including your wife, as a threat. And it's amazing how our pets become, you know, possessive of us as well. You know, sometimes that can be manifested through aggression, you know, possessive aggressive type behavior. Can it be changed? Certainly, it's certainly going to take a lot of work and a lot of redirective type behavior. You know, trying to take that aggressive behavior, tone it down, and reward her for, you know, for good passive behavior. But she's a Jack Russell. She's a terrier. She's got a mind of her own, and you know, that's something that part of you know, behavioral issues like that is just making sure that you're keeping those around you safe, first and foremost. And then you know, getting a trainer in the house, and you know, someone who's well versed and you know, has helped others in that kind of situation is always a great idea.
Sam, thanks for the phone call and good luck to you. I see the phone's still ringing. We're going to get as many of your phone calls in this hour as we can with Dr. Eric Harima, who's my guest from Penfield Veterinary Hospital. Short break and much more Unleash the Pet Show right here on Connections next. Coming up in our second hour, it's Second Opinion Live. And in this edition of Second Opinion Live, we're taking a look at how we can finally succeed when it comes to New Year's resolutions. We'll talk to a primary care doc, a cardiologist, and a smoking cessation expert. Three of the big areas where people are making resolutions. That's next hour on Second Opinion Live.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Natural Pet Foods Company, helping people make diet choices for their pets, offering frozen and grain-free foods and foods for pets with special needs. 766 Clinton Avenue in the South Wedge, naturalpetfoodscompany.com. And the financial advisors of the Sartini Group at Morgan Stanley, 585-987-6053. Investments and services are offered through Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, LLC, member SIPC.
Welcome back to Unleash the Pet Show on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson here with Dr. Eric Harima answering your questions. And as we always do on Unleashed, we've got some stories from our community, from the Rochester Finger Lakes region, the animals and their stories around here. And you're about to meet, a remarkable pug named Gypsy and the caring people who fought to bring her home. It's a story of hope and maybe even Christmas miracles.
In November 2013, as snow blasted a path through western New York, a pug, lost and scared, fought for her life, and no one seemed to be looking for her. Brenda Trombley has the story of pug love. She spoke with a big-hearted people determined to bring this lost dog in from the cold.
Jennifer Everett, an EMS worker and known animal lover and advocate, heard about this pug running through her hometown, darting through traffic on some of the busiest roads in the area. And the pug was scared, really scared, of people.
She was terrified of humans. She had, sadly, never known the kindness of humans. She had always just been a commodity. And then we found out she didn't really have a home. Nobody was looking for her.
Knowing every minute counted, if they were going to bring this pug in alive, Jennifer had to act fast to enlist the help of as many people as possible. So she set up a Facebook page that said, Operation Grease Pug Rescue in Effect. Working with her friends, Carla Iannucci and Carol Bartel, Everett named the dog Gypsy because of her wide travels. And they activated a wide network of people to help track her through the streets of Greece and the surrounding area.
There were days where it was 2 and 5 degrees out where she was living through the night. And if you're familiar with a pug's coat, they don't really have much of an undercoat. So the level of anxiety went up for a lot of people, worried about would she make it through the nights? Was she even going to live? What we would do is we would ask people to spot her and let us know where they see her so that we could set up a feeding station and try to get her to eat in a location. And then we would try to set a trap.
Hundreds of people started looking and posting, strangers working together for the good of Gypsy. But Gypsy was quick, and it was clear to those trying to keep tabs on her that they were going to need to use technology that could track her in real time.
One of the things that we use is Google Maps, and we set up a map of where the dog started from and then the path they're taking.
Jennifer points to some paw prints on the northwest corner of the map where the suburb of Greece is located.
So Gypsy started up here where there's a paw print, and we can change the icons. And if you look on the side here, there's notes. This is where Gypsy was spotted. We continued following her. This is where down in the city, had the help of RPD and the PAWS truck from point A to C. And as she traveled through the town of Greece and the city of Rochester, we could update her map online and people could go directly to the link and see if Gypsy was in their neighborhood or in their area.
Shelley Pione was one of the people who got plugged into Gypsy's plight. The pug had first been spotted on the run on Shelly's birthday, and Shelly was already an owner of a pug, so she felt a special connection to the pup, and she was terrified that Gypsy would not make it out alive.
Once I saw her Facebook page and a little bit of her backstory, that was it. There was no sleeping, no nothing. Everything revolved around this little girl in the dead of winter. We would lay in bed at night. I mean, we would pray for her, that she would just be kept safe another day. She was always just one step ahead. We would be in an area, flyer in heavily, and then a call would come in, and we would be right there. We were on that street. We were one street over. I mean, this happened several times. Sometimes I wondered if she was even real.
Which is why, in the new world of lost pets, old school methods still have value.
Hey, would you take a look at this flyer? If you've seen this dog...
While using high-tech tools, Operation Grease Pug Rescue posted flyers in the neighborhoods where Gypsy was spotted, and they called on some of their friends in high places.
I know some of the 911 dispatchers. They may have called and said, that pug you're trying to find is over here. And the police officers knew we were looking for her. Animal control knew we were looking for her. And a school bus driver called and saw her on Emerson Street. She was heading south into the city now. It was almost like a unfolding drama episode. People were captivated on Facebook as Gypsy's seen here, Gypsy's here.
2 weeks of searching through snow, traffic, and cold led Operation Grease Pug Rescue to the day before Thanksgiving.
It was sort of game over. There was a big storm coming in. Everybody was terrified that she wouldn't make it through the storm. How would she even be able to get through the snow with those little pug legs? So this map allowed us to stay live the entire time, and we would repost the link so people could follow to see where little Gypsy had been along the way. Last Grease sighting, crossing Westridge Road towards the Hess station, like her ass was on fire. That was what the lady called it as. She saw her on a flyer.
And then, in a cold industrial park surrounded by chain link fence, an impromptu team of strangers raced around buildings, cornering Gypsy as she desperately looked for a way out.
You can see down here where there's a whole bunch of paw prints. This is where we caught her in the end. This was all the people pulled in here, closed the gate, completely fenced. Somebody was able to pick her up. There's no way to describe the rewarding feeling of finding that lost dog, finding the lost pet, and then also handing it back to their owner. There's no way to describe it. So that's kind of what drives you.
But Gypsy didn't have an owner, so now it was time to find her a home.
I had the pleasure of 4 people that were excellent homes for her. Not every dog out there has that luxury, but her story was so sensational and everybody knew about it locally here that I could handpick who I felt was best for Gypsy.
One of those 4 was who else but Shelley Pione.
I figured with the amount of people at this point were in love with her and involved, I just thought, wow, there's no way we would probably stand a chance. In the meantime, we had a son who was deployed, and Christmas was difficult. He had just left at the beginning of December, so we were struggling. My daughter and her husband pulls in the driveway on Christmas morning and handed me a card. I opened the card, and there was a little pug on the front of the card in a Christmas outfit. And I opened it up. It said, Merry Christmas. I'm yours. Love, Gypsy.
Brenda Tremblay bringing us the story of Gypsy. Nice to have a happy ending there. It doesn't always turn out that way. What a remarkable story. And Evan Dawson here for Unleash the Pet Show this hour of Connections, joined by Dr. Eric Harima of the Penfield Veterinary Hospital. Nice when you get a happy ending like that,
yes.
Dr. Harima.
Yes, we like happy endings.
Well, we certainly do. We can get your questions in for Dr. Harima. We've got a pile that have come in off air and online here. I want to get Catherine in Greece's question. She wants to know, Dr. Harima, if smoking in the house affects pets? And you know, the assumption is yes, but she's wondering just how significantly secondhand smoke can cause health problems in dogs, cats, birds, etc.
Certainly it can be significant, and obviously I think it's in part related to the amount of exposure as well. But you know, I think we all know that secondhand smoke is you know, been a major contributor to human health issues, and you know, so just extrapolating to pets, it would certainly affect them as well. In particular, cats, you know, do suffer from asthma, and you know, the smoke can certainly be a trigger for asthmatic kitties, and they can you know suffer from that pretty significantly. So, without a doubt, I would just you know go outside. You know,
can they get lung cancer like we do?
They can, you know, as far as the amount or the incidence level, I think we probably truly don't know. I mean, it's easy to take x-rays and see masses in the chest to be able to come back and actually say this is a you know, carcinoma related to potential smoking is probably less likely. But yes, they can get cancers related to the lungs.
We had, well, my mother had a Siamese cat named Puying. Puying is Thai for girl, by the way. My father had been stationed in Thailand. So Thai for girl. Puying was the name of our cat. And she was 15 years old. She sat on my mother's lap every day for years. And my mother smoked in the house. My mom has thankfully stopped smoking a good number of years ago. But Puying would sit there and my mother would just chain smoke. And I thought, this cat's got to be addicted to smoking. Well, we lost Puying when she got out of the house. She was an indoor cat. She got out at some point, I think, during a family party and accidentally got out, and we never saw her again. Very sad. But somebody in the family asked an honest question. Is there any chance this cat could be, like, going through nicotine withdrawal? She sat there for 12 years at least on a lap of a smoker.
Great question. I would say anything is possible, but yeah, I have no idea. Quite honestly, I wish I could give you a good answer, but
it's hard to interview cats about that.
Of course, yes.
isn't that something? I don't know. Are you seeing any more cancer now than we used to, Dr. Harima, in animals and pets and house pets?
You know, I think it's a great question, and I would honestly have to say that I probably haven't been practicing long enough to say, are we seeing it more now versus, you know,
10,
I graduated,
20, right,
I graduated in 2003. So, you know, just, you know, some of the other veterinarians in the area who've been out 25, 30 years may have a different say on that. I think we're probably better at finding it. I think it was probably there, you know, 10, 20 years ago. It was just a matter of, you know, were we looking for it, or
sure,
were we going to that point to tell owners? Because I think certainly, you know, what we do for our pets has changed in the last 20 years. And, you know, doing blood work 25 years ago may have been, you know, out of the question. Now doing blood work, x-rays, you know, abdominal screenings, ultrasounds, MRIs, it's, you know, we have a lot of, you know, technology at our disposal to give answers.
So better at finding it, but yeah, better at finding it early or early enough to do something about it?
Potentially, yes. You know, and that, again, that comes to the owner. You know, when things are off, you know, we got a mass on the chest or, you know, on the flank that's been growing, it's red, it's irritated. You know, if that's a mast cell tumor, the sooner we see it and the sooner we remove it, the better chance we have of making sure it hasn't, you know, gotten to other parts of the body, to the lymph nodes, to the spleen, mm-hmm, you know, abdomen, that type of thing.
How often are you doing that kind of operation?
Oh, it just depends. I mean, it's there's not a week that doesn't go by in our hospital that we're removing, you know, masses, whether they're benign or malignant. You know, that's what we find out after the fact. But a simple aspirate out of the mass, you know, in an outpatient visit, you know, can tell you a lot.
That can also be a very, very difficult decision for a family. I mean, pet's part of the family. And depending on the age of the pet, depending on the pet's health history, the cost of the operation and the family's means, I imagine sometimes people say to you, what should I do? Should we have the surgery or not? And that's not something that you can readily decide. Everyone's different. But do they ask you? I mean, do they want your counsel on, is it worth doing this kind of a procedure?
Oh, sure. And I think, you know, the first part is the diagnosis, whatever type of cancer we're talking about. And, you know, that may be as simple as a biopsy. It may be more like removing a spleen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so to get the answers, it may be significant hurdles you need to go through. You know, our role as a veterinarian is to present options, and, you know, certainly there's going to be cost to those options, and, you know, the more you're able to do as far as investigation and diagnostics, the more informed you're going to be, so that we can say, you know, once we have that diagnosis, this is how we can treat it. This is how responsive it is to chemotherapy. Or maybe, unfortunately, we say we can't treat this. You know, we take a chest x-ray and we know there's something in the abdomen and there's already metastatic nodules in the chest, and it kind of might stop us in our tracks a little bit sooner.
Dogs, cats, what type of cancer do you see most often?
Most common cancer in both dogs and cats is something called lymphoma. So that's probably the most common type of cancer. And certainly cutaneous masses like mast cell tumors in dogs, you know, pretty common. You know, for cats, as far as cancers, you know, I would say lymphoma is certainly the most common one. But, you know, they can get bone cancers. They can get splenic tumors, some angiosarcomas, yeah.
And for a lymphoma, are you typically seeing that on any kind of a routine checkup, or are you typically seeing that when something is markedly wrong and a pet owner is bringing it in?
It depends on the situation. Some owners will, you know, the appointment description says check bump or check bumps. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you ask them, you know, what are you appreciating? And say, well, geez, I'm feeling these things underneath the chin when I pet her that I've never felt before. Or, you know, there's just these bumps, you know, that are kind of in different areas of the body that are really big. And so astute owners who have their hands on their pets, you know, very routinely will be able to pick that up, you know, pretty quickly. And then, you know, now it's our job to, you know, try and figure out, is this lymphoma? Because that would be a common presentation for lymphoma. But yeah, other times it is, you know, oh, by the way, have you seen this mass back here, or you find something on the pet that the owner hasn't recognized? And it could be something small, you know, and to them was insignificant, but, you know, from a clinical relevancy and experience standpoint, we may see, you know, something that's, you know, more to it than meets the eye.
A couple more questions that have come in via Twitter, and you can use the hashtag Unleashed, or you can find me at Evan Dawson on Twitter. My friend Norma, who has a couple of Chihuahuas, her beautiful little rats, as she calls them. You know, they're getting older, and she's worried about their health. And she says, and this is something I don't think Dr. Harima can answer, but I'm going to let Norma air this out anyway. She says, when's Rochester going to get an animal cardiologist so dogs and cats with heart problems don't have to go to Cornell? There was one, but she left in 2013, and one was supposed to start this year but took a job elsewhere, as far as Norma understands it. Is that right? Are we sending...
Yes, we are, and unfortunately, Cornell is at the point where they're kind of short-staffed in regards to cardiologists well. So we are desperate for cardiologists to come and spend time and stay in Rochester, New York, you know, from our clients to our veterinarians, you know, to everybody involved, because they serve a significant role, and there are lots of things that, you know, can be related to the heart that we can treat and diagnose, but the skills of a cardiologist certainly are such an asset to have in you know, your ability to refer to someone closely.
Boy, here's hoping that changes then sometime soon, maybe in 2016. Short break. We're coming back with Dr. Eric Harima from Penfield Veterinary Hospital. He's our guest for the hour on Unleashed, the Pet Show, here on Connections. You want to call with any questions for Dr. Harima? We'll try to fit those questions in between now and the end of the hour. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. And if you've ever thought about getting a pocket pet, a so-called pocket pet, some considerations you should make, that is next on Unleashed. Welcome back to Unleashed, the Pet Show on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. If you've got a question for Dr. Harima, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or if you're right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Back to your questions in a moment, but first, did you know chinchillas can live to the age of 20? So bringing a pocket pet into your home is not a decision to be made lightly, as WXXI's Beth Adams discovered when she recently spoke with veterinarian Dr. Ember Kucher.
What are we talking about when we say pocket pet? It sounds like such an adorable name, and I'm sure they are adorable, but there might be some exotic creatures in there too, right?
Pocket pets has really kind of taken on a variety of meanings that can range anywhere from rabbits, which really aren't traditionally pocket pets, to smaller animals like gerbils and, you know, dagoes came in and were popular for a while. Some of the smaller marsupials like sugar gliders. So it has a range of sizes, not always something that would fit in the pocket. But yeah, and there are some more, you know, the more common species, and then there are the more exotic species that we see as well.
Pocket pets, I'm guessing, a lot of times are maybe the first pet that a child might have.
I would say that's very common. And they're convenient, they're small, they don't take up a lot of space. So they're a place where people feel like they can get their feet wet with an addition to the family.
But do they deserve the same kind of consideration that a dog or a cat would have in terms of, you know, thinking about, can we afford this pet? Do we have enough time for this pet? Do pocket pets get that same kind of consideration when a family's making those decisions? Or because they're tiny and maybe they, in some cases, don't live as long, maybe people don't take that as seriously.
Well, and that probably that advanced consideration is not as common as we might like it to be. I think the same consideration should be given regardless of the size or species of the pet as to, do we have the time for this pet? Can we accommodate their needs in order to provide them with a good quality of life? Should something go wrong, where can we take this animal to seek help? Who knows, you know, who's knowledgeable about this species? You know, if you go with something that's truly exotic, you may be in trouble when it comes to healthcare because we may not have a great deal of knowledge about what this animal needs and what types of illnesses they would experience and how to help them. So I think consideration, regardless of large, small species, et cetera, should be given in advance.
Well, I know some of the smaller pets, like the hamsters that I was familiar with and a lot of people had as kids, don't live as long. But do some of these pets have longer lives?
Their life expectancies can range quite a bit. If you look at chinchillas, they can live up to 20 years. Some of these animals actually live longer lives in captivity than they would in the wild because they're more of a prey animal. And some animals don't live anywhere near as long in captivity, probably because we don't know exactly how to properly care for them yet.
What are the biggest mistakes you think people make with pocket pets in terms of their care? When you think about things like habitat, are they happy sitting around in a cage all day?
No, I think if you look at a snapshot of the animal in its own environment, it's going to be quite a bit different. We provide them with safety and comfort, warmth and food and all of those sorts of things. But what we haven't taken care of the animal's social needs and lifetime, you know, habits of the animal day to day. They spend a great deal of their time foraging for food, creating appropriate housing, nesting, that sort of thing. And when we provide everything for them in a bowl, they really have nothing much to do with themselves. So environmental enrichment is a huge issue for these guys that we don't probably look at enough.
Are there any types of little pocket pets that come to mind that aren't a good fit necessarily for kids?
There are. Some of the animals tend to be more bitey, if you will. And so with a small child that doesn't understand what's happening and why that happens, you can see the child be injured. It can damage the relationship. The animal may be injured if it's, if it falls during an episode like that. So those are not, you know, that animal, the personality traits of the animal should be taken into account. You know, rabbits are not necessarily good for small children. Rabbits are very reactive. A child picks them up and they struggle, they get dropped or they fall, and it's not anyone's fault. It's just, again, forethought could prevent that from happening.
Mm-hmm. It's nice to be able to bring your family pet to the vet, regardless of whether they're ill, just for the annual checkup. Should the same be true of a pocket pet?
I cannot stress enough the value of regular exams for these animals. At the very least, when you purchase the animal, when you bring it into your home, have it checked, because that is the time that if the research hasn't already been done on how to properly take care of this animal, we can provide you with that information. We can look at the animal, make sure that it's healthy, it doesn't have parasites, that we can prepare you for what sorts of things could be a problem down the road so that you know what to look for when those things happen so that we can catch them early. We can help you to discover the management needs, get them on a proper diet, get them on the proper bedding so that we don't have problems later on. The biggest cause of health problems in small animals, and the more exotic the species, the more the problem occurs, is a result of management practices that were not correct for the species of animal.
So you weren't doing the right diet, the right care of the animal.
Right. And it's not that anyone shoots to not take proper care, but it's very misleading if you walk up and down the pet food aisles and you see, you know, gourmet, let's go with guinea pig food, and it's got corn and red things, and gourmet, it sounds good, and it has all this, you know, this is the best thing for your animal, but that's not really the case. So seek the guidance of somebody who's familiar with the species to help you get the management correct so that hopefully we can have a nice, long, healthy, productive relationship.
Dr. Kuchar, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
That's my colleague Beth Adams with that story on Pocket Pets. I'm Evan Dawson here live with you on this Friday, the third Friday of the month. And the first hour is always Unleashed, the Pet Show on Connections. And Dr. Eric Harima from Penfield Veterinary Hospital is in studio with me. How often are you seeing any pocket pets out there?
Rarely.
Not too often, huh?
You know, we refer to our dear friend Amber Kuchar and Joanna Hawk over at Cats and Critters because, bottom line, you know, as a veterinarian, there's a lot of species you can study. And if you don't, if you A, don't have the interest, or B, don't have the knowledge, you know, there's someone in the Rochester area who can help you and they can do a great job for you.
Nice to know that there are people who
exactly
who you can direct to. So there you go. Let me get back to the phones. Mary in Rochester has a question for Dr. Harima. Go ahead, Mary.
Oh, hello. I was just wondering, Dr. Harima, if you could speak to feline parasites, especially lungworm.
Yes, we can, Mary. Are you familiar with lungworms?
I certainly am.
And how so?
I do have a cat right now who's being treated for lungworm.
Yes, so cats and dogs can get lungworms, and it's a parasite that can actually go asymptomatic, you know, so you're not seeing any clinical signs related to it. And, you know, the lungs actually reside in the, or the worms actually reside in the lungs. They start reproducing within the lungs. They cause an agitation or response within the lungs. So therefore, the cat or dog might start coughing. As they cough up the eggs, now they swallow them into the GI tract, you know, it goes through the stomach, small intestine, out through the colon, and, you know, out with the feces. So now you've got eggs in the environment that are there to reinfect, you know, other potential cats and dogs. And, you know, if they're eating the grass, soil, you know, other animals' feces in general, there's where the reinfection occurs, comes into the stomach, and then the, you know, the lungs are smart, or, yeah, the lungs, the worms are smart, or the larval forms of those, and they know that they're supposed to migrate, you know, from the gastrointestinal tract back up into the lungs. And once they get there, they start the life cycle all over again. So they're nasty. They do cause clinical signs, but the good news is we can treat those, as I'm sure you are well aware.
Yes. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary. Thanks for the phone call. Some questions that have come in online for Dr. Harima. This comes from Stephen, and he says, how do I keep my lab from eating her own poop?
Yes, very simple answer to that one. Pick it up before she can eat it. And there are some ways, you know, some deterrents. There are some, you know, medicines that you can put into the food. What it does to the taste of the feces or the smell of the feces, I have no idea.
You would think that that would be enough, but apparently not.
Exactly. But, you know, inherently, you know, from a nature standpoint, it's not necessarily, some species routinely eat their feces to impregnate their bodies with the good bacteria,
okay,
you know, needed to, you know, to aid in digestion. But a lot of time, you know, especially with a Labrador, you know, they just, they'll eat anything. So, you know, the meat tenderizer is something that has been used in the past, or MSG, I should say more specifically, which really isn't on the market, you know, over the counter anymore. But, you know, if you talk to your local veterinarian, you can get little tablets that have monosodium glutamate in there, and that can deter them. The goal is to break the cycle of eating the feces over the course of like a 5-day period. But, you know, usually they come back to it, and especially in colder weather, you know, we call them poopsicles. You know, the dog comes in with, you know, just this, you know, kind of brown grin as it comes in and it's wagging its tail. Yeah, so bottom line is just get out there with your pet, and, you know, while it may be cold and wind, and, you know, wind is blowing, pick it up, and if you pick it up, they can't pick it up.
What's the short answer on the biggest risk or the biggest concern with the dog eating that?
If there are parasites, you know, if that dog is carrying its own parasites and you're not using routine parasite prevention, you know, just reinfecting itself and reinfecting the environment. So that would be the biggest risk.
Okay. Sarah wants to know, any idea why our golden retriever constantly licks the floor? It's a little nutty.
Yeah. So that can be certainly just a idiosyncratic personality trait. Some dogs, do lick things that are inanimate. And, one of the things I always wonder is, do you have stuff on your floor or floor cleaning solutions that that may have a taste that your dog likes? I've got children at home. Invariably, there's always stuff on the floor, food-wise. We do our best to pick it up. But, dogs are very good at finding those things very quickly as well.
So would you be worried about it?
No. Not necessarily. No.
Okay. All right. Well, so I wish there was a better answer for you, Sarah, on that one. And Paul wants to know, said, found a tick on our dog recently and dug it out. Should we be concerned?
So, yes, you should be concerned because ticks are, without a doubt, probably one of the biggest issues we have right now with ectoparasites. You used to talk about fleas a lot, but ticks spread a lot of diseases. There's the diseases we do know about, and then there's the diseases we don't know about. But Lyme disease is a big issue, with ticks, and there's some other diseases that they can spread. But this is a time of year where you're going to see deer tick activity the most, as well as into, as we go through winter, early in spring. They're very common. But the longer the tick is able to blood feed, the more potential they can inoculate the host with bacterium that can cause problems.
Okay. So, and forgive my ignorance on a tick. I mean, I'm familiar with the frantic reaction that people can have when there is a tick on a person, on a child, and try to get it out quickly before it kind of burrows, right? It burrows in dogs, or I guess is the same.
Yeah, every tick is going to burrow. And it just depends on when you find it. It may be, not attached yet, but once it's attached, their saliva acts like a glue that keeps the head into the host body so that they can continuously suck blood.
And, but you shouldn't assume, Paul is saying, well, I was able to dig it out. Sounds like you got it quickly. Shouldn't assume, but would you still take it in and see a vet in that case?
If you've removed the tick and there's a little bit of the head portion in there, that's not going to become a problem. The stuff you're worried about is in the body. Most importantly is, are you using prevention for your pets? Are you putting, using something that's going to kill those ticks before they can actually feed long enough? That's the most important thing. And I think that's the call you would make to your veterinarian to say, hey, I found a tick. What do you recommend? I removed it, but I'm not using prevention. If you're not using prevention, let that let the veterinarian be the source of information for you.
If they can't get it out themselves, I would imagine you've removed a lot of ticks.
Sure. Oh, sure. Yeah, we have these neat little tools that are called tick twisters. Work phenomenally well, and it's almost like using a hammer to pull a nail out of wood. But I've had 100% success rate in how many ticks I've removed. I don't know, hundreds. It usually works all the time.
All right. And once you do that, are you also doing some testing, follow-up?
It depends. And what it depends on is, A, the species. Cats, we don't seem to realize, there are some new tick-borne diseases that we're seeing, not so much in this area. But with dogs, Lyme disease, if that tick was feeding long enough, we would recommend a test in about 8 weeks to see if there is a immune response to the bacteria that causes Lyme disease. And that way we can inform the owner, here's the potential of what Lyme disease can do to your pet.
Okay. Well, we've got about a minute left. What's going to keep you busiest this time of year? As we go into the holidays, we go into the winter, what keeps you busiest?
You know what? Right now, because we don't have snow, we don't have cold, we don't have frozen ground, it's allergies, believe it or not. It's not the, a lot of people would say Christmas time and chocolates and foods and things like that. But right now, allergies are terrible because we have warm days and cold nights, and that perpetuates a lot of mold and that type of thing in the environment. And, we get a lot of dogs who have allergies, and their allergies are seasonal. And if we can't get out of their season, by getting into winter, they're still kind of suffering from that. So that's been, keeping us busy right now.
Well, thanks very much for being here. It's been great talking to you, and we appreciate, I know our listeners appreciate your expertise and the answers to the questions, so thank you so much.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Dr. Eric Harima here from Penfield Veterinary Hospital. If you're out and about this weekend enjoying Rochester during the holidays, you can be sure to visit the Unleashed Table at the Holiday Pet Expo at the Garden Factory. That's tomorrow, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Again, 10 to 4 out at the Garden Factory. So thanks so much for being here today, and thanks for listening to Unleash the Pet Show. You can let us know what you think about Unleashed by tweeting us at #Unleashed. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/UnleashedPetShow. And if you have a story about your pet or an animal, a great story you think that we should hear all throughout the Rochester Finger Lakes region, or maybe a story of service, heroics, or second chances, email your story idea to unleashed@wxxi.org. Unleashed@wxxi.org. Second Opinion Live is next.